Tonight on This Is Vinyl Tap, I'm in this dump motel near the Taco Bell without a hope in hell. Could we have kippers for breakfast, mommy dear, mommy dear? Gotta have them in Texas, cause everyone's a millionaire. Goodbye, Mary. Goodbye, Jane. In 1948, Columbia Records introduced the 33 and a third RPM long player record. 1 year later, RCA Victor introduced the 45 RPM single. Listeners now had a choice, only the hits or the full album. In the last half of the 60s, the best bands realized the potential of the longer format and began to build a cohesive body of music that must be heard unbroken. The arrival of downloadable music has increased the temptation to stay in the shallow end with the hits. This podcast believes every album tells a story. Tonight, we tell one of those stories. Tonight, we tell one of those stories from 1979. My Sharona is the biggest hit, along with Bad Girls, La Freak, Do You Think I'm Sexy, the most tragic song in all of rock and roll, and Reunited by Peaches and Herb. Billy Joel stands on top of the albums with 52nd Street, followed by the Bee Gees, the Doobie Brothers, Minute by Minute, the fantastic debut from the Cars, which we should probably stop and talk about for an hour, and this album, ladies and gentlemen, Supertramp, Breakfast for America.
Breakfast in America.
I mean, in America. I'm a little hungry, so I'm being selfish with breakfast for America. All right. Also, Pieces of Eight came out that year, JM. Ugh. So my question to you is, given the fact that Pieces of Eight came out the same year, how is it that you picked this album?
You know what's surprising? I have a lot of those albums you just mentioned, or I had those, and that kind of ties into this. I have a very
long... Do you have La Freak?
I do have Chic. I do. Chic, I believe.
I believe they're in the Rock and Roll Hall.
I believe they are, yeah.
Cummy people are not in normal things. We're back in the music capital of the world, ladies and gentlemen, Austin, Texas, and we are south. And I don't mean just a little south. We're south of Ben White, ladies and gentlemen. And we're next to a... Well, some of y'all might know we're next to a street called Manchac that apparently they've misspelled the street signs.
How did that happen?
They changed the name of it.
I think California came in and said, we like Manchac better.
It's a long
because we're such wonderful people and we're sensitive. Anyway, it's still Manchac to me and it's still Town Lake to me. So, California.
It's still 19th Street.
All right, back to T. And we're at Tony's house. We're in his daughter's room. He's thrown his daughter out. She's in college. And it's pretty nice here. We got a fan that doesn't make noise. And we got stacks of records and CDs. And we've got JM trying to tell us what happened after church every Sunday in the summer.
All right. So once a year in the summer, no matter where we lived in Texas, after my dad's church service, we would all pile in the car. Didn't matter where we lived, Corpus Christi, San Angelo, Mason. My brother and I would pile in the car with my folks, and we would head to our family cabin in Estes Park, Colorado. So that's a pretty long trip. And for the first several years that we would do it, the only thing we had was AM radio.
You could play I Spy.
Yeah, when we had auto bingo. I think that was another thing that we would do.
You didn't play Slug Bug?
We played Slug Bug. And my brother and I would fight. But then in 1978, we upgraded to a car that actually had an 8-track player in it. Yeah, so you know, I don't know if y'all are familiar with the 8-track format, listeners, but it was...
I think most of our listeners probably are.
Yeah, I think most of our listeners are.
Yep. Unfortunately, we have very few listeners that don't have a history with an 8-track.
Well, our European listeners may not, but it was in the United States and Canada, I read, it was the most popular format for recorded music.
What, Europeans don't like their songs interrupted in the middle?
Well, that was the thing about it. The 8-track, you know, you could not rewind. You could only fast forward. And I don't even think we had that in our car. So you would have to kind of listen to one song and then you'd have
to listen. That's perfect for what we preach around here. Mm-hmm.
Then you'd have to listen to, even if you didn't like the next song or, you know, you'd have to listen to the next song or silence before you could hear another song that you liked. But anyway, playing these 8-tracks it became important that I liked all of the songs on an album. And really, one of the few albums that I actually had that was on 8-track was this album. And I bought it, I think we got it through the Columbia House, one of those, you know, 13, 8-tracks for a penny.
And then you end up spending several thousand dollars on records.
You do what I do. You just ignore the fact that they're sending you stuff, and then they eventually leave you alone.
Yeah. I mean, we had all sorts of crap. We had like Casey and the Sunshine Band. We had Barry Manilow. I mean, there weren't any record stores really where I lived. So we were kind of at the mercy of what was on the radio or, you know, buying these 8-tracks. But this album was one that I remember actually looking forward to because I liked every song on the album. And it was one of the first times that I can remember actually liking every song on an album. So this is that I've got a, you know, pretty
sentimental feeling.
It's a sentimental feeling. But then, you know, grew up, we got, a cassette player in there and we started listening to Walkmans and stuff. So the 8-track in this album just kind of disappeared.
Went the way of Puff the Magic Dragon.
Went away the Puff of Magic very, very well. But then several years later, or many years later, I was dating this woman. And she lived in, her parents lived in San Antonio. So we would go, you know, take a lot of road trips to San Antonio. And she actually had this CD or this cassette. And I remember just, you know, again, kind of, oh, it's all these, like, I remember really liking this album. And so we'd listen to it on those road trips to San Antonio. And then we broke up. And again, this album just kind of fell out. You know, I just forgot about this album. And then about 5 or 6 years ago, I was listening at work. I was just listening to music, and you know how, I guess it's Spotify or Amazon Music, they'll put a set list together for you, and the song that came up was one of the songs that came on was Breakfast in America, and I had forgotten completely about this album. I'd forgotten completely about this band even, and I remember just I could sing along with every song, and I stopped immediately what I was doing and put on the album Breakfast in America. And ever since then, I have listened to this album. It's in a pretty regular rotation. I think it's an album of very good songs that are very well constructed. I think they're very well played. I think it's original, especially in its use of woodwinds. It's also interesting to me, the more I listen to it, I'm always interested in getting a European perspective on the United States and American culture. And this album does that in spades. And like I said, the songs are really tight in their construction, but they're kind of loose in their feel, I guess is the best way to describe it. It doesn't really seem like, let's just jam these songs in a studio and see where they go. They seemed like they were very well constructed, but they still have just kind of a whimsical nature. And it's kind of just a fun album, I think, too, overall.
Well, you're not alone, JM. This album has sold 20 million copies.
Wow.
This was they had some hits before, but this was a breakout album. One of the top selling, what was it, number 5 for the year. And I would also say it's very different than the music that was popular at this time.
Yes. I mean, just listen to, that list.
What we'd like to do now is to, we'd also like to mention this was a huge hit in Canada.
Well,
and just like us, mm-hmm. they're much more, they're disproportionately popular in Canada.
But it wasn't just this album. This band was,
yes,
I believe they broke, like Canadian radio broke them for North America. Mm-hmm. They've been huge in Canada ever since.
I think Diamond Records.
I want to say, I don't remember which album it was. It might have been the one after Crime of the Century that broke in Canada. But they, once they hit in Canada,
That one with the piano on the cover.
Even then, the quietest moments.
Yeah.
That was taken in outside of Estes Park, Colorado, by the way.
But I want to say, I think every album after that, even the ones after Hodgson left, charted in Canada.
Is that right?
Huge, yeah. Wow. Huge, huge, huge in Canada.
Huh. Well, I want to discuss the elephant in the room. we've kind of stepped around it so far, but let's just dive in. Compared to some of the records, I think of Derek and the Dominoes, television, where does this rank as a guitar album?
It's pretty low.
It's a Wurlitzer album.
Yeah. I think
we have the two main dudes are keyboard players. And they don't seem shy about playing keyboards.
Well, it seems like once they discovered this particular sound, they just stuck with it.
Yeah.
They stuck with it.
And that sound is the Wurlitzer piano.
It is.
Let me ask a question about what's going on here, because I don't know. This is the most identifiable, maybe after Cassinets, this is the most identifiable thing, but it sounds like they're playing chords only on the piano. Like, it reminded me of Steve Allen when he used to do the show on PBS. Everybody could think about how sophisticated they were, and they'd laugh harder at jokes that weren't as funny, where he'd do a little political.
That wasn't Steve Allen.
Who was it?
That was Mark.
Oh, yeah.
No wonder I couldn't find any videos of Steve Allen doing it.
Yeah, Steve Allen wasn't so political.
He was on Real People for a while, too. I forget his name. Mark something.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so glad you said
that. The Capital Steps or something like
that. No. He was independent, but he was a political commentator who played the piano.
And he would do that. Dun, 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 dun.
Yeah.
So I thought that maybe that's like when you're just singing a bunch of words and it's the equivalent of playing a guitar with just the chords. And then I realized when I started looking at the albums that were popular at this time, it sounds a lot like what Toto was doing also.
Yeah. I mean, that Wurlitzer piano, it's a Wurlitzer electric piano. I should be more precise. Yeah, that.
What is that?
Mark Russell, by the way.
Mark Russell, that's what it is. Yeah. I always sound just like Steve Allen.
they both had glasses.
That's it. Lucky I didn't say Tony. What is that going on? Is he playing chords with both hands, and then the other guy is doing more intricate things?
Well, I think that of the two, the Davies guy is the better keyboard.
Well, I don't think there's any question because
he tended to do some more runs, and you know,
whenever you see them live, is that type of playing called something? Because it's dominant on this.
Yeah, record. I don't know what you would call it, but
I got another question. This album seems to be almost a concept album, but maybe an accidental concept album. Is this the result of them touring the United States while making or?
I think they were actually living in the United States.
They were, but what's weird about that question, Doug, is several of these songs were written when Roger Hodgson was 19 years old. So I'm not sure how.
Really?
Wow. Yeah, I'm not sure how that fit. You're right, because there is a theme running through this album. And it's kind of one of, what would you say, like disillusionment and some other stuff.
Well,
it's,
there's
a lot on
a lot seems to be arriving on our shores and finding out that we didn't live up to whatever they picked up on television and music. Which, same thing happens to us when we go there.
We can get more into this when we talk about the song, but in particular, the song title track "Breakfast in America" was written when he was 19 years old.
He hadn't even been here yet.
He hadn't been here yet. It was all about dreaming about, because the Beatles had been, and he was influenced by that. And I don't know how much of it changed. Like they probably changed throughout the years, but there's, I think, at least three songs on this album that were written when he was under 20.
That theme, it would be great if it was a concept album with that theme. Because this is one of the greatest album covers of all time.
Absolutely. Yeah. Iconic. It's up there with anything Hypnosis ever did.
Yeah.
I agree 100%.
Yeah.
And for those of you who don't have the benefit of a memory, or the album right in front of you, it's basically a waitress holding a menu, and is that a shake?
It's a shake, and
she's dressed like a classic American cafe waitress, and Manhattan's behind her, except so instead of Manhattan, it's salt and pepper and ketchup,
and she's basically the Statue of Liberty,
right?
And
she has a great look on her face, and apparently she's an actress that they continue to have contact with.
Here's something. Two interesting things about the album. One is, believe it or not, this album, the only Grammy it won, because it was a monster hit, was for best recording package based on.
Recording package.
Yeah. That was a Grammy, I guess, at some point.
Who won?
They won for that.
No. I mean, who won the album of the year?
Oh, I don't know. Do you know?
Billy Joel.
Oh, well, that makes
52nd Street.
And then there's three interesting things about the album. I forgot the third one. The second thing is they actually had a contest, because you look at the back of the album cover, they're sitting around a breakfast table reading five different British newspapers. Mm-hmm. And they had a contest that each of those British newspapers would pick a reader and a guest, and those two people were flown to New York to see Supertramp at Madison Square Garden. They had a 3-day free vacation, flown there for free. So that was kind of cool. And then the third thing, and this is going to cause you to play the Crosby, Stills, and Nash, I'm sure. The same guy who did this album cover did the cover for Spilt Milk by Jellyfish.
Oh, really? I can see that.
I can see that, yeah.
Well, one thing I want to say is that this waitress, if she worked at a cafe near my house, I would be going there all the time just to see her smile.
Yeah, she looks awesome.
And to hear her say, "Hun," it would be well worth it.
Oh, what happened?
quite the segue.
We were just talking about the Doobie Brothers, but we got the Doobie. All right. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a segment we call Connections. This is where we connect this episode with previous episodes, and we try to find how is this band, its members, its production, its engineer, whoever, how's it connected to albums we've already talked about? How many albums have we already talked about? We're like 150 or something.
121,
I think.
Yeah.
Wow.
Maybe, well, we haven't released all of them, so maybe around 125.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway. That's a lot. And what's so funny is my mom keeps going, "Y'all running out of albums?" Which I view that as the exact opposite problem. I think we're going to run out of years life, before we run out of records, because every day I think of something else I'd like to do.
Yeah.
I'm going to go to Jonathan J.M. Rowe first. Don't tell us what season, but if you could... Do you have a connection, Jonathan J.M. Rowe?
I'm going to steal Tony's thunder on this one. The producer, Peter Henderson, has worked with Rush. He didn't work on the album that we talked about, but he worked with Rush. And I guess the Beatles, too, because he worked with Paul McCartney.
Mm-hmm. That is not... You didn't steal my thunder. Okay. I wasn't going to even mention that.
He's got so many. He wouldn't get mention that sorry one. Tony, do you have a connection?
I do. It's one we actually talked about on a previous episode. So when Roger Hodgson was 18 or 19, fresh out of boarding school, before he joined Supertramp, in fact, pretty much right before, he had a demo tape that he got into the hands of somebody in London, and they wanted to record a song of his called Mr. Boyd. And the band and the band was called Argosy. I guess that's how you say it. And the he had three session musicians with him. Well, there's kind of two connections with that. One is, he said when he was trying to start to get in the music business, the only connection he had to the music industry was right down the street from him, Traffic was living. So he would go down there and knock on their door and bug Traffic from time to time. I don't think anything came from that. And we've talked about Traffic a couple of times on this episode. Not done a Traffic album, but we talked about them with Dave Mason and also with Blind Faith. But the session musicians on this Mr. Boyd song were none other than Caleb Quay, Nigel Olsen, and a piano player that was at the time known as Reg Dwight. or Elton John. And I was going to
Rockin' Johnny.
I was going to play you guys with what that song sounds like if you want to hear it.
Sure.
Oh, this is Mr. Boyd by Argosy. So yeah, that's Elton John playing piano, and like I said,
that sounds
I like that.
Basically, his band. I think all three of those guys were actually on Tumbleweed Connection, which was the Elton John album we talked about.
Yeah,
so
very good connection.
Yep. Sounds very flower power.
Jonathan Jim wrote, Tony's really done a good job on connections. Would you like to give one?
I don't really have any other ones.
Do you not have one, Doug?
I wanted to let y'all have a chance. It seems like I always dominate this segment, and I've just been feeling. No, I don't.
I've got two more.
Tony, do you have any more?
Yeah. So in between, so we'll get to this when we talk about the history, but the first two Supertramp albums were not very well thought of by the record buying public
or the critics.
So before they ended up developing their classic lineup and going into play to record Crime of the Century, both Roger Hodgson and Rick Davies went in, and because the year before that they had toured with 10 Years After, and they went in and we did a 10 Years After album, and they acted as a rhythm section for an album called You and Me, which was by keyboardist Chick Churchill of 10 Years After. So there's a connection there. In fact, Rick Davies played drums on it, which was the first instrument he ever picked up. So it was kind of interesting.
And actually, this album sold more than the 10 Years After album we covered.
It did. You know what? Here's one sort of loose connection, if you will. After Hodgson left the band, because he left the band, I think, in mid-'80s, early 80s, and they continued, Rick Davies continued with the band afterwards, they released an album called Brother, Where You're Bound, and on that album was the title track, had David Gilmour playing guitar on it. And
really?
We talked about Pink Floyd as well.
So, well, that's something.
There you go. Yeah. Those are my connections.
Not overly connected.
No.
But
I'm sure there's some we missed someplace.
Yeah. I know. You know, I got so desperate, I typed up Supertramp connections to other bands. And
didn't get a whole lot.
I don't even remember. It took me on another goose chase that had nothing to do with what I was supposed to be doing, which is the first time that's ever happened to me on the internet, ladies and gentlemen. finally, what kind of music is this?
It's not prog.
It's not prog, but it's...
But people like to say it is.
It's proggy, I guess.
I don't think it's proggy either. In fact, listening... And it's tough to listen to those first two albums because they're hard to find. You can't... If you go
that's the only reason?
Yeah. Well, I don't even think those are really proggy in the sense that I think of it. I guess they are in that they're a little bit complicated. They're very long musical interludes. Maybe they're... I don't know.
Do you think some people are more inclined to classify something as prog if it has keyboards in it?
And it's long? Yeah, probably. I think so. Because I felt like that earlier stuff was a little bit more, I don't know, fusion-y, I guess? Or I don't even know if I'd call it that. I don't know what I would call it. But
Davies is a jazz guy.
Yeah, yeah, he is. Well, and one of the guys who was... We'll get that as well. One of the guys who was in that first iteration of Supertramp ended up writing all the lyrics for the John Wetton era King Crimson. So
really,
he left to be a lyrics writer for those guys.
Yeah. Huh. So, I mean, I don't know. Maybe other people were. I mean, I have a very narrow view of what I consider prog music. Other people don't. So maybe.
Well, what about people calling this art rock?
Yeah, I was about to say, is it art rock?
This album's not.
No, I don't think it is.
This is a pop album.
I don't even know that
pop
I would
rock album.
Like, even in the quietest moments in Crime of the Century, I don't know if I would call those necessarily art rock. I don't know. Maybe that one long song on
Crime of the Century. I think they moved away from that when Crime of the Century came around because they got these other guys in, and Hodgson started taking a little bit more of a... Because he's the pop guy in the band. He was the guy who had to...
Yeah.
Rick Davies always wanted to play these kind of extended long jams. I think... Yeah, I think this is like pop rock, but I don't
wonder if in 1979, when Prague was fading out, that maybe it seemed progger than it would have if it came out earlier.
That's a good, yeah, maybe. Good observation.
But listen, I mean, even listen to a song like Dreamer. That's not a progressive rock song.
Well, right. I don't hear anything prognacious about it.
Yeah. You could almost, I don't know, maybe you could say Bloody Well Right has a what kind a of a prog
song.
Element.
I love that song.
You're bloody well right. You got a bloody right to say. Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
Full disclosure, I lean towards Rick Davies' vocals more than I do Roger Hodgson's vocals.
I think we all do.
I think Rick Davies' vocals on this album are so important.
Yeah.
Because yeah, so if you had to go... 10 songs with that other voice, it'd be almost like listening to a Chipmunks album
guys,
or something.
Guys, and this is coming from a Geddy Lee fan.
I know, yeah.
But, you know, and I just for also for full disclosure, the people in the UK might be asking why we're saying Rick Davies. I believe it's pronounced Davis in
Great right?
Britain. I think so. Because
how do they pronounce the Kinks?
Davis.
Davis, really? Yeah.
They do?
I believe so. Yeah. Uh-huh. If I'm wrong about that, you can write
us anyway. Let us know.
Yeah, write us and tell us if we're wrong.
Tell all your friends to listen to us to hear how wrong we are.
Yes. Everybody listen.
Okay, so I'm glad to hear that we're not diving into a prog band because I was about to say I have to start over on prog if these guys if these guys are prog. So
I think the only thing there's two things. The use of keyboards. I mean, even on stage, there's the woodwind player plays keyboards. There's three keyboardists, a bassist, and a drummer.
But their keyboards aren't what you consider, what I consider.
Well, they're not they're not played virtuosically.
And they're not
Certainly some are not at all.
They're not complicated.
Like, no, they sound like somebody just taught their kid how to play this song. They just go like, dun, 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 dun.
That's why, again, I think there's this pop sensibility to this music, and that's why it got the popularity that it did, and that's why it's still popular. I mean, these guys are still playing on, they're still big.
This is a timeless album. It does not sound like it came from 1970.
I might disagree a little bit with that.
I'll tell you, that soprano saxophone and...
I don't know.
There's a lot of things. And then there's remind me of the funny thing is when we did Jellyfish, I kept hearing this band so much during the Jellyfish
confession for me, I haven't listened to Supertramp in a very long time. I used to own this album and I got rid of it. I'm not really sure why. I think I just got worn out on it. And I never got that connection. People talk about outside of, you know, New Mistake having that outro that's very logical songy with the piano and the castanets. But in listening to it this time, and I've never, even when I own this album, I never listened to it as intently as I've listened to it this time. Mm-hmm. When the song Breakfast in America came on, all I could hear was Jellyfish at that point. It was like, holy cow. I see it. I get it now. I absolutely get it now. That song is, you can see where they influenced the heck out of that band.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I've mentioned before that one of the worst things about doing this show is learning how many albums I used to have that I no longer have. And this is one of them. I can still see where I signed my name on the corner of the album, but it's gone now. And I did have it shortly after it came out and listened to it quite a bit. And I was surprised how much of it I remembered. And I have very ambivalent feelings about it that we'll discuss later.
Few albums. I think I own 52nd Street and this album. I got them soon after they came out.
I saw that 52nd Street tour. He was quite a showman. Speaking of something besides me, where did these guys come from?
Well, I think if we're going to talk about the history of the band, we got to start with Rick Davies because he's kind of the impetus of everything. He was born, and this is another loose connection. He's born in Swindon. JM, what other band is from Swindon? One of your picks.
It's ABBA, right?
That's sweet.
Oh, my bad.
I believe XTC is from Sweden.
I believe you're right. Anyway. Yeah.
His musical journey started when his parents gave him a secondhand record player when he was 8, and it came with some records, and one of them was Drummin' Man by Gene Krupa, and he says that just knocked him over the head like a thunderbolt. A family friend made him a little drum kit out of a biscuit tin, and that left that he went off rolling with that. Eventually, he got some real drums. He took lessons. By 12, he joins the British Railway Staff Association Brass and Silver Jubilee Band as a snare drummer at 12 years old.
12 years old, wow.
Yeah. In 59, he gets the rock and roll bug. He joins this band called Vince and the Vigilantes, which is a pretty cool name. He's attending college in 62 in Swindon College, and he starts his own band called Rick's Blues. Bad name. He's playing a Hohner electric piano instead of drums at that point. The drummer for that band, Gilbert O'Sullivan. You guys know Gilbert O'Sullivan?
Gilbert and Sullivan.
No, Gilbert O'Sullivan wrote Alone Again, or sang and I think wrote Alone Again Naturally.
The church where people sing, my God, that's tough, she stood him up. No point in us remaining, we may as well go on, as I did on my own, alone again, naturally.
He said Davies taught him how to play. Davies' dad gets sick, so the band breaks up. He goes and he takes a job as a welder. Eventually, he joins another band in 1966. He joins a band called The Lonely Ones. Noel Redding was in that band. He wasn't in the band at the same time.
Is that right?
Yeah. When Noel Redding had left in 66, I don't know where he went.
Okay. Yes. Noel Redding was the...
He was a classically trained guitarist, wasn't he, that switched to bass?
Yeah. He wasn't a bass player originally.
Well, I imagine if you're in Hendrick's band, you're like, wow, there's no reason for me to even touch the guitar at this point.
I want to be in the band, but Noel I don't Redding, want to play guitar.
So Hendrick's bass player, the eventual bass player.
I love his bass player.
Noel Redding was in The Lonely Ones. He's not in the same band at the time. But when Davies joins it, he's playing keys and he sings some lead. In 67, that band ends up changing their name to The Joint. And the following year, they go to Munich and they start getting work recording soundtracks for these low-budget German films. Even with this, the band is kind of struggling financially. In the next year, this weird thing happens, and they end up meeting a Dutch millionaire by the name of Stanley August. I'm going to screw up his last name. It's Mesegius, I guess. We're going to call him what everyone else calls him, which is Sam, which is his initials.
Okay.
So he's interested in the band, but he's particularly interested in Davies. And he becomes their financial bank backer and their manager. Huh. He moves them into their villa. He adds some recording equipment to the basement, and they get a rehearsal room so they can cut some demos. Sometime in 68 or 69, they record an album's worth of material that they thought was everyone thought was lost to time, but it was actually released a couple of 7 years ago. I want to play you guys a track called On the Other Side by The Joint, and this song was co-written by Davies.
On the other side, there's no money, but there's milk and honey on the other side. On the other side, the moon is flying.
So, who's that singing?
I don't. It's not him.
Sounds like the call to prayer.
But it is. It is. To be fair, the transfer isn't the greatest because they found these tapes. I don't know, in a box someplace or something. But it sounds very late 1960s, including the lyrics. Anyway, so in February of 69, The Joint ends up signing to Robert Stigwood's organization, and we talked about him with Blind Faith, because he was Cream's manager, right? Anyway, in May of 69, they appear on Swiss TV in Geneva, and then they appear at the Marquee Club. Sam is really disappointed in the progress of the band. He goes up to Davies and he says, listen, I will continue to support you. I like you, but you got to leave this behind, and I want you to start your own thing.
Wow.
So he leaves The Joint and he starts his own band, and he puts a The joint basically breaks up. He puts an ad in Melody Maker, where all great bands start, right? And the first person to answer the ad was a guitarist by the name of Richard Palmer. He had been a band called Ginger Man that had just ended. Little side note, John Wetton was in Ginger Man. And he had also auditioned for the fledgling Wishbone Ash, but he chose to go with Davies's group. Another person to answer the ad was Roger Hodgson, and we've talked about him a little bit. I want to briefly talk where he's from. He went to boarding school.
Yeah, he comes from a pretty upper middle class background.
He taught himself.
I'm glad he went to boarding school.
Yeah, why is that?
Because the song it inspired.
Oh. He taught himself how to play guitar, and he began writing songs at the age of 12. He also taught himself how to play the piano, the bass, the drums, and the cello. We already talked about Argosy, which was his kind of his big deal, his breakout. They also, finally, the final piece is they get a drummer by the name of Keith Baker, who'd also been with the joint, and they decide to form a band. And the band's name, do you guys know what the first name of this band was before it was Supertramp?
No.
Daddy.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah.
Horrible name.
They were afraid it was going to be confused with another band.
Some bands didn't come up very good.
No. The band is, like we said.
Daddy Long Legs. They were scared they'd get confused with that.
Well, that's why they changed their name. So Daddy at the time.
Daddy Long Legs is a much better name than just Daddy.
It is. I think so. Rick Davies is playing keyboards. Roger Hodgson's playing bass at this point. Richard Palmer is the guitarist, and Keith Baker's the drums. A few months later, Baker is replaced by a drummer named Robert Miller. And there's actually footage of Daddy performing at this place called the PN Club in Munich. They're performing a 10-minute version of All Along the Watchtower.
No, thank you.
I'm gonna play you a bit of it because I think you need to hear this. Yes, Daddy.
It kind of progged that up.
Yeah, I thought the bass sounded good though.
I think we'll put that on the website so you can see the footage of it. But anyway, as we mentioned, they were worried about this band called Daddy Long Legs, and so they changed their name to Supertramp, and it's based on a book called The Autobiography of Supertramp by William Henry Davies. The name is a coincidence. In spring of 70, they're signed to the UK branch of A&M Records. They were one of the first bands signed to that particular – the UK branch of A&M. The other – one of the other first bands was the Straubs. So they're signed in spring of 70, and by July of 70, I believe, they released their debut album called Supertramp.
How'd that album do, Tony?
It was a commercial flop.
Finally, I got to use that.
By the way, Rick Wakeman was in the Straubs.
Oh, thank you. Jeez, there goes my prog cred.
All the same. Just noodling piano players.
Now, Rick Wakeman is on some great albums.
Oh, yeah.
Including Hunky Dory.
Here we go with Is There Life on Mars?
Oh, gosh, that's a good song. I'll never live. Making fun of me. Anyway, so after that album, Richard Palmer ends up quitting. And as we mentioned, he becomes a lyricist for King Crimson. And he writes lyrics for Lark's Tongues and Aspic, Starless and Bible Black and Red. So that John Wetton era of King Crimson. Supertramp initially replaced Palmer with a guitarist named Davey O'List. He is on the debut album by The Nice. He lasts one gig. They add Dave Winthrop on flute and saxophone. In 1971, Bob Miller quits because he suffers a nervous breakdown while they're on tour in Norway. And so Davies and Hodgson, they're like, we need a new rhythm section. And they get a bassist by the name of Frank Farrell, who also played piano and accordion, and a drummer by the name of Kevin Curry. And this is when Hodgson switches to from bass to play guitar as well. And they released their second album called Indelibly Stamped. that's released in June of 71. It's got a very interesting album cover.
Very strange album cover.
That's up. How come we keep running into topless album covers that are not at all sexy?
I don't know. That was
a, looks like a man to me.
No, yeah, it's an ink art model by the name of Marion Hollier.
Who looks like a fat man.
Anyway, Davies. So one of the things I forgot to mention on their debut, Hodgson sings most of the leads on their debut album.
Is that why that guy quit after one gig?
I don't know. By their second album, Davies is serving as their second lead singer, because Hodgson's like, we need to share the duties here. Some of the songs start to feature Davies on the Wurlitzer, which would become part of their signature sound in later albums. This album,
Hodgson.
It's...
We're losing Canadians.
He says, I'm not doing this anymore. And he leaves. He leaves the support. Everyone in the band up at that point, except for Davies and Hodgson quits. So they're clicking. So they decide to continue. It's around this time that they do that album with Chick Churchill. And they end up holding auditions for a new band. And this is what would become the classic lineup of Supertramp.
Which I think would last about 10 years.
Yeah, they recorded, I think, 5 albums for 10 years. So it's Dougie Thompson on bass, an American drummer by the name of Bob Siebenberg. Yeah. John Helliwell is kind of a multi-instrumentalist. He plays saxophone, other woodwinds, occasional keyboards. He does backing vocals as well.
He's kind of their MC at their live concerts.
Yeah.
Have you ever watched it? Watch him live. He's the one who's talking to the audience and all that. Yeah.
And then Hodgson ends up starting to play keyboards and piano as well.
He becomes rhythm piano player.
Yes. And then their third album is kind of when lightning strikes. They A&M sends them off to this retreat at the 17th Century Farm, and they pay for their housing and their food while they end up recording 42 demos. A lot of demos.
That is.
They select 8 for the album that is going to become Crime of the Century. Ken Scott produces that.
Ken Scott?
Yeah.
He was a producer and an engineer. And he's been with... I think I've heard of some of these.
Hunky Dory, right?
Yeah.
Elton John, Pink Floyd, Poco Harlem, David Bowie, Duran Duran, and the Jeff Beck Group. Also Supertramp. So... I don't know. If you don't know some of those, you can look them up later. But
yeah, he's kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
Anyway, the sessions run longer than they're supposed to. They were recording down between February and April 74. They're creating sound effects by hand, and they're using items that aren't musical instruments. This increases the cost, the time, and what they're doing in the studio. Jerry Moss, the head of A&M at the time, did not like their first two albums. In fact, he didn't want to release them in the States. They eventually do that. But he goes to hear what's going on with the band now, and he likes it enough to say, keep doing what you're doing. In fact, we'll extend the time in the studio, and we'll extend how much money we're giving you to do it. So that's kind of a big, big deal. The weird thing is Hodgson and Davies had been writing songs together for the most time. By this point, that ends, and they just essentially come to the studio with their own songs, and the other guy adds flourishes, kind of like a McCartney-Lennon thing in later years. Yeah. As I mentioned, they'd written several songs, but they only pick 8 for this, and some of the songs that they wrote of the 42 were released on other albums, or say for them, some of them are unreleased. But this album starts to showcase that electric piano a lot, which is essential to their sound. Mm-hmm. And there's 2 songs on this album in particular that kind of are a big deal. The first one was a big hit called Dreamer. And that song was written when Hodgson was 18 or 19. And he brought the demo to the band to play it, and they couldn't get it right in the studio. So they end up putting it on 2 separate tracks, and then having the band play along with it, and that seemed to work. Huh. That song peaked at 13 in the UK. The other song I want to play off that album is a song called Bloody Well Right.
So that was a good selection for to hear how
different
they can sound like they don't sound.
And that sounds kind of proggy. I mean, that still, it also sounds like the chorus of Oliver.
It sounded like
Consider Yourself.
When it got heavy like that, it sounded a little bit like a Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
It sounded like Jeff Beck. I mean,
I prefer that song to Dreamer personally, but whatever.
I do too.
I thought that's a great sound. I wish we got that more frequently.
That song, I think, got a lot of airplay in the U.S. It didn't necessarily get airplay other places for some reason, but it got because I remember hearing it on the radio a lot when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that album is a success. It goes to number one in the U.K. It stays on the German charts for 93 weeks.
Wow.
The band had a following in Canada, and A&M Records, we talked about this, broke the band in North America, A&M Canada. By 1976, that album had been on and off the Canadian charts for 2 years. They gave us gave Supertramp the highest sales of anywhere in the world. Crime of the Century was the first album in Canada to sell over 1 million copies, making it the first to receive the Diamond Award in Canada. Hmm. So, big deal, right?
Yeah.
It's a huge deal in Canada. So, their album after that is called Crisis, What Crisis? And according to Hodgson, that LP is how they learned how to not make an album. Because they
don't like it.
What's that?
They don't really.
Well, what happened was they came off the road. There was a lot of pressure after Crime of the Century. You know how record labels are. We need product.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of pressure after Crime of the Century to go back in the studio. And he said that they went in and did it too quickly. And they had the songs, but because they rushed it, they didn't come out as well as they wanted to. It was made up essentially of unreleased songs that they'd already done because they didn't have a whole lot of time to play things out. But oddly enough, at the time, at 200,000 pounds, it was the most expensive record A&M had ever made up until that point.
Really?
Yeah. And it topped the Billboard Hot 100. It topped out at number 44. This is when Jerry Moss said, okay, it's time to enter the U.S. And so he finances 30 shows in the U.S. and Canada. And the first date they ever play in the U.S. is April 4th, 1975 in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And they're pretty unknown in the U.S. at that point. And A&M actually lost money on the tour. I think they gave tickets away to a lot of people to get people into the crowd. They were hedging their bets and trying to hope there'd be future royalties and stuff. That helped. Touring helped and radio helped. By 1976, Supertramp was Billboard's number six band in the top artists performing at auditoriums with less than 6,000 seats. Now, they weren't selling out stadiums, but they were making some money at that point. So then their next album is Even in the Quietest Moments. They take a four-month break from things to write new material for this album, and they tap Jeff Emmerich. Who's Jeff Emmerich, guys? We talked about him a couple of times.
The engineer for the Beatles.
So that album ships to the U.S. and Canada as platinum. It ships platinum. In Spain, it stays on the charts for 80 weeks and was number one longer than any record in the Spanish charts history.
It's a kind of an interesting album. It was recorded, they were living in, or had been in Los Angeles for a while, and they were recording there, but they wanted to get out of Los Angeles to record, so they recorded at Caribou Ranch.
Outside, in
Colorado.
We've talked about that. That's where
we've been there many times.
Elton John's played. There's a bunch of people that have recorded there. And that's where
where Wish You Were Here from Badfinger was recorded.
I believe you're right. It's the album cover was, you know, it's the one with all the snow on the piano.
Uh-huh.
That's the one that was taken at the ski resort that is right by where Caribou Ranch used to be. Caribou Ranch burned down and they never
rebuilt it.
Yeah.
Well, here's another song that was a monster hit off of this album that was written when Hodgson was 19 years old. It's called Give a Little Bit. I'm sure you've all heard of it.
That sounds like a Canadian hit.
Number one in Canada and the Netherlands, became Supertramp's first top 20 entry in the States. It hits number 16 in the Billboard 200 and number 19 on the Cashbox Top 100. And the album hits number 15 in Great Britain a month after its release. So,
wow.
It's a big deal. I'm sorry. The album is what did all that. That song peaks at number 15 on the Billboard Hot 100, so that's a big deal. That essentially, guys, brings us to the album we're talking about tonight.
That brings us to Breakfast.
So there's some pressure on them, or not pressure, but they felt like they were kind of at a point where they needed to break. And so they put a lot of effort into recording Breakfast in America, a lot of painstaking work on this album.
Yeah, they spent a lot. Well, one of the things they wanted to do was they didn't necessarily want to mix it. What they wanted to do was to have the sound in the studio, which when you're recording, you really don't want anything extraneous. There's an old saying, don't ever record effects. You put the effects on afterwards. So if you're putting it, don't record with reverb, don't record with compression.
Sounds like you've been talking to Todd Rundgren.
Oh, Todd. Yeah. So you there, and but that's not what they did in this. And it turned out that it made mixing the album
hell
for them. So it was something like,
so they recorded all the stuff instead of putting it on afterwards,
right? And they said actually mixing the album and trying to, because they would record, they would do different takes, and they would want to put the take from one onto, you know, and use it, the take from another one, but the EQ would be different. And there's, to this day, the engineers on this album are still not happy with it, even though it's been remastered.
They couldn't do the old Strawberry Fields thing.
I don't think they could. Yeah. So yeah.
One of the things I forgot to mention when we were talking about the album cover is, so this album was released on March 9th, and at 9 a.m. on March 9th, 30 radio stations in 17 countries had a visit from a lady dressed like the waitress Libby, carrying a tray of orange juice, a croissant, coffee, and a specially made porcelain cup, and the first copy of the album for the radio station.
What a cool idea. Yeah. I wonder who gets credit for that.
I don't know. But anyway.
Very smart.
Yep.
You know, that, and the woman who's on the cover of it, she was an actress, and I think she was a pretty, had done a lot of TV shows and stuff, but she says that her, what she's known for is that album cover.
It's a great, I mean, it is a fantastic album cover.
It is. Yep.
All right.
One of my favorites, the cover, that is. All right. T, thanks for taking us down that memory lane.
Long road.
Of things I don't remember. We've got an album that's about to start here, ladies and gentlemen. We have 10 songs, and we're either going to have a song. We have two songwriters, so we'll keep track of that as we go through, even though it's really obvious.
Yeah.
I believe the way they worked this out was, and it's the same thing with McCartney and Lennon, right? Is the person singing lead is the person who wrote the song.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Except it's much easier to tell who's the singer.
Yeah, it's pretty easy there's to figure sometimes, out who wrote it.
There's sometimes you, Lennon and McCartney could sound alike, but yeah, not here. We start off with Gone Hollywood. All right, fellas, I have a question for you.
Sure. Alrighty.
How is it that this song starts the album?
The first line in my notes is, this to me is an odd song to start the album with.
It is an odd song. I guess because it fades in and it last song fades out. But
you could do that to any song.
I know. I mean, the way I always see, whenever we talk about what a great way to start the album, it's a song that draws you immediately into the album. I don't think this song does
that.
Well,
it takes forever.
You know,
it
sounds like an overture the way it starts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Except it's not connecting to themes that you'll hear throughout the album.
I also feel like as this song goes on, it loses momentum, which is a weird thing.
It doesn't seem like, it seems like it's most of the song's an introduction. And then when it stops being an introduction to itself, it really doesn't know what to do next.
Yeah, that bridge where it's the sax and the piano playing off each other, just sort of, I mean, it's nice, but it's a weird thing to have the album start off with.
I agree with you, but I think this is a fantastic song. I don't think it loses momentum. This guy's down in the dumps, and he's having all of this, you know, getting rejection, and, you know, he's trying to make it in Hollywood. And then you have that kind of long stretch where he's kind of walking around trying to figure out what he's going to do with his life. And then he makes it. And all of a sudden, the song takes a turn. It goes from, it's been in this minor and kind of suspended chords and everything. And then at the very end, it goes to a major. And that's, you know, everything's all bright and sunny at that point. He's in his big car. And another thing I love about this song, this is a theme that they do in this on this song, on this album, is that the backing vocals are kind of like
grating.
a chorus. It's like
they're commenting on it.
Yeah, they're commenting on it. It's like a Greek, you know, not a chorus in the musical
like
sense,
like a Greek chorus in a
tragedy.
And this is going to be something that probably comes through a lot. And we've mentioned it before. I will admit that I find Roger Hodgson's vocals a bit
tedious
after a while. I hate them on this song. I find them absolutely like nails on a chalkboard.
It's the worst. I guess it is the worst, but there are other points. I don't know why he's so much more obnoxious as a background singer as he is.
Yeah.
It's true. It's absolutely true. With the exception of Goodbye Stranger.
But again, I like that it's irritating because I like it again because I think it works because this guy is busting his ass and he's not.
I saw JM before he came in going outside and putting pebbles in his shoe so he could walk around and be irritated about him.
There's a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Whoever the Mr. Hyde.
Hyde.
On this album, it goes from some of the brightest, sunniest, optimisticest stuff you can hear, and then it can get dark.
And there's lots of songs that have that thing we've talked about before, where the music is fun, and then the lyrics are like, "Holy cow, these are horrible."
That's true.
There is.
This is written by Rick Davies. He sings lead on it, although they share leads. We talked about that. They share vocals.
If we only have time for you, is that part that,
You know, I don't know. Do you remember your first time to go to Hollywood?
Yeah. I was old.
Mine was, I was 20-something. And
I was 13 or 12.
It's an ugly place with ugly things everywhere you look.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why. I guess because movies come from there. You think it's going to be this
glamorous
magic place.
But yeah.
I was, ironically enough, I was at A&M Studios for I guess it was about 2 months. I was stuck absolutely doing nothing but driving.
Did Herb Albert come in and say hi to you?
I didn't see Herb Albert. You know, what's funny is Springsteen was, there's three cars parked out front now. Almost all the time. One was a Jeep that was Don Henley's, and Springsteen had this old, worn-out looking 69 Camaro.
That seems perfect.
With like the upholstery on the, and they were both in the studios, but I never saw them while we were there. But I remember Hollywood just being, I just thought it was nasty and gross. And
it's not as bad as it used to be. They've cleaned it up some, but it's still.
It was really bad.
Last time I was there, I guess I was in, about 15 years ago.
And I've been there since then. Captured. I wonder what it's like right now. Have you been?
I remember.
I've been in the last 5 years.
I remember Grauman's Chinese Theater was a big letdown.
No, it's everything's a letdown, and I think that's perfect since Hollywood is so much what it's not.
Yeah.
But I do think the song nails that kind of.
I agree with that.
Being a dump near a taco, there should not be a Taco Bell in a magic place called Hollywood.
Yeah.
But there's a Taco Bell and everything else horrible there. Yeah.
That all being said and done, I just find the song a little boring.
Huh. Well, I don't.
The reason I listened to it is because this is Vinyl Tap and we don't skip songs. We do albums. Yeah. Nothing there for me.
I love the guitar playing on it. It's got at the very end where they.
I might feel different if this was sequenced differently and this song was someplace else. Yeah. But when you put the album on, it made me kind of remember why I don't own it anymore. So, anyway. Yeah.
All right. Well, up next comes a remarkable song, which is their biggest hit ever.
Yep.
The Logical Song. There are songs, I guess there's four songs on this album that you have heard
a gazillion
even
times.
If you tried not to because they were ubiquitous on the radio.
Yeah.
And this is one of them.
And it's, that's the Wurlitzer piano at the start of this thing. And,
that with that and the castanets. If they were trying to sound more like themselves, I don't know what they would do.
Well, yeah, and that's the part that's in that outro of New Mistake that sounds, you hear it, and you're like, that piano, and it is. And the castanets, you're like, that's the Logical Song.
Yeah. It's such a whimsical song. I love the...
Except for the lyrics.
The lyrics aren't that... uplifting.
It is whimsical and really heartbreaking at the same time, which is, I think, perfect for this because he has been bullied by the world, but he hasn't lost his nature despite all the things he's singing about. And I think that comes across.
I always think of that part in Clockwork Orange when they're making him watch the movie, and he's at the end of it. He's still the same guy that he was.
This song does for me this. I've talked about this before with other songs. Killer Queen by Queen is one, and New Mistake. I'll bring it up again. Those are both songs that I love and adore because they're so full. Like every bit of this song is used and full of sound. This song is the exact same way.
And
there's no empty space on this song, and it works so well.
I love that party whistle that comes in on it. And then Mattel.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So after they say digital, there's a bleep. I had no idea what it was, but it's the Mattel handheld football game.
Yeah, so the noise.
Because I guess Rick Davies played it all the time. They're like, well, let's just add it to the song.
It's perfect.
It's absolutely perfect.
I don't seem shy about tossing things into the song.
No. So he says that he was alone by himself, and he was sad at the Wurlitzer. This is Hodgson, and he's playing, he's playing around with the chord progression, and he's doing it off and on for a couple months, and then he starts singing the melody, and the first word, you'll love this, Doug, the first word that comes out of his mouth is liberal. And so he's like, immediately he starts singing words that rhymed, intellectual, radical, logical, and the whole concept just comes pouring out of him. He says, right away, I knew what I wanted to say. The song was born out of the questions that really mattered in life. Throughout childhood, we're taught how to behave, yet we're very rarely told anything about the deeper purpose of life. Hmm. And then it is a prime example. But when they sent me away to teach me how to be sensible, logical, responsible, practical, then they showed me a word, world, where I could be so dependable, clinical, intellectual, cynical. I mean, it's a critique of the education system he was a part of, right?
Yeah.
I think this song is a brilliant, brilliant song.
It may
very
be the
well,
best song.
If it's not the best song, I don't know what is. Yeah. It's well done. It fits his voice perfectly because his voice has a a frail, fragile, and youthful sound to it. It's so strange that we come across this album right now and this song right now. I've been in the process of meeting with groups of supporters to start a private school. And one of the things we talk about over and over again is...
Supertramp?
No, we haven't, but I probably should bring this song up, is we teach kids without starting with the basics. And that's what this song's about. Mm-hmm. What is your life for? Mm. What's your purpose? Who are you? And we start with, we're educating you so you can be a productive member of society. Well, that's fine for society, but that doesn't answer any of the questions these kids or any human being. It's not just kids. Right. What am I for? I'm not here to support society. Society's here for me. Yeah. And I'm very, very sensitive to the points he makes in this song. And they're absolutely correct. It's a brilliant song.
He had total control over his song. He orchestrated every single bit of it, including down to the drum fills. Here's some interesting things about this. So this song hit number one in Canada, number six on the Billboard Hot 100, number four on the Cashbox Top 100, number two in the UK Singles Chart. It is the biggest hit of their, we talked about that, of their career, reaching, you know, heights. In 1979, Paul McCartney was asked what his favorite song of the year was. This is the one he said.
It's such a weird, I can't believe this. It must have just hit a chord with people because it's really
Everybody realizes. I mean, and we say it's about their school system. It's about every culture. Every culture suffers from this problem of not starting with the basics when explaining to kids what... The first question everybody has is, what am I here for? And what am I? And we ignore that. And I think that hits everybody right between the eyes when they hear this. Mm-hmm. There's no one that goes, wow, what a weirdo. I'm not surprised at all. I'm not surprised at all McCartney dug it.
It also won something called the Ivor Novello Award. Yeah, I don't know what that is.
It's lyrics and music. It's one of the where it they say that the lyrics
some
and the music.
Some prestigious award.
Yeah,
anyway,
some very prestigious award. It's not. I don't think it's given every year. I think. But it's a. This should have opened the album, I think.
Probably.
As far as I'm concerned, nothing on this album reaches the shoulders of this song. It's just above.
It's funny. The
all
next
of
one's
them.
My favorite.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well,
I like the music on the next one.
The next song.
Let's see what happens next.
All right. What's the song?
Ladies and gentlemen, Goodbye Stranger.
It was an early morning yesterday. I was up before the dawn. And I really have enjoyed my stay. But I must be moving on. Like a queen without a throne. I'm a early morning lover, and I must be moving on.
And let's get that turned down before any background vocals start.
This has got, I think, the greatest diminished chord in rock. That second chord that he hits, and that boom, doom, doom, and when he's singing.
That's a hook that they start out with that piano deal. It's an immediate hook.
I love everything about the song, including the background vocals. I love how it crescendos up. Yeah. It just builds and keeps going. I love that chugging guitar sound that happens in the middle of the song. Love that.
Yeah, I do too.
It's got some pretty great guitar work from Hodgson on it.
And that last part is just, it starts just one note.
Yeah.
And he's putting it through a phalanger and it's making
What's
that,
a phalanger?
A phalanger is something.
That's a man that's not loyal to his wife.
It's an effect that kind of gives it an airy sound.
It's great.
It's really cool.
I love the whistling in it.
Yeah.
I love the bass line. I just love the song, period. This is one of those songs I can hear a million times and never get sick.
Oh, and I love
it.
That little arpeggio guitar part. I mean,
way it punctuates those certain lines.
Guitar, you know, he's not a masterful guitar player. I mean, and none of these guys, I guess Hodge Davies is sort of a pretty good keyboardist, but they're not. None of these guys, I think, are virtuosos on their instrument. But that's kind of what gives it its charm. So going back to the background vocals, mm-hmm. again, we got that kind of chorus thing, I think, going on.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right.
Is the lover that's being jilted, is she basically saying, don't let the door kick you, you know?
Oh, I don't know.
Hit you in the ass on the way out?
I don't know. That's a good point.
I don't think so.
Yeah,
she gets her revenge later, or someone representing all of... I put this into the free bird category of songs, which the last song is one of my favorite themes in all of music, and this is one of my least favorite themes of all of music. And it's essentially a celebration of selfishness.
It is.
And they try to make the channel romanticize it. Like,
sweet devotion is not for me. Yeah.
I'm as free as a bird, babe.
No,
or
the other one is
What's Your Name by Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Lynyrd Skynyrd, yeah.
No, he's leaving her, doesn't even know her name.
I think you're right. This is a guy who doesn't want to get tied down. He's all about being able to hop from bed to bed.
But that's the thing I like about it. It sounds like he's a loathsome character, and I think that comes through on...
Well, it does.
Yeah.
Very clearly.
So this song...
I think it's meant to.
I'm not saying he didn't mean to write it.
Yeah. All right. But I get what you're saying. So the logical song is something that connects to you lyrically as well. It's funny. I sing along with the song, but I love it so much. I don't really think about... Maybe I should. I don't think about the themes. I just...
Maybe I ought to bring your wife in here and tell her how much you like this song.
Yeah, musically, I just think the song is perfect.
Yeah.
I love his vocals on it. I love both of their vocals on it. This song hits number 6 in Canada. It tops the singles chart, and it's number 15 on the Billboard Hot 100. It's number 57 in the UK, number 32 in the US Adult Contemporary, number 15, I already said this, on Billboard, number 16 on Cashbox, and number 9 on the adult contemporary charts in Canada. This was a big deal, this song, as well.
Yeah. And his he's got a strong voice. He's got a really, really good voice.
Yeah, mm-hmm. He does. It's hard for me to believe he's British. He's got that...
Isn't he Irish?
Huh?
Is he Irish?
No, he's born in Swindon.
Oh, that's... Yes. He's got like
that,
ABBA.
That Procol Harum guy's voice. He's got... Yeah. They almost sound...
It's a big voice.
It is a big voice.
I wish he was a better songwriter so we could hear it through good stuff more. I'm so glad this song is on this album, because by the time we get, I guess as soon as Take the Long Way Home is over, I start really feeling sorry for how unbalanced this album is.
Oh, I agree with you 100%. 100%. I can't remember the last time we talked about an album where side one is significantly stronger than side two.
Well, and I did... That's true, I mean unbalanced by songwriters.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah,
because I think after Take the Long Way Home, it just sort of dives after that.
I think
one song.
Lord Is It Mine, I think, is a worthy piece of stuff. But I'm not going to disagree with you. I guess 6 is side one, right? I mean, the first track of side
one, two. Yeah.
Is supposed to be.
Yeah, Long Way Home is the first track on side two.
So that's Goodbye Stranger. And up next, we have the title track.
We do.
Breakfast, not for, but in America.
I like that kind of... It's an interesting song. This may be my least favorite song in the album.
Really?
Yeah.
Like I said, I hear jellyfish in this song and over and over again.
I think it's a good song.
I think it's a good song. What is it? Is it a waltz? Is it a...
It's more like a march. Okay. It's because it's got that oompa band kind of stuff going in it. Those horns are played by Slide Clyde.
Well, there you go. Bring old Slide Clyde in here.
Slide High.
This song's why we're experts, right?
Is this the one that says that we're going to have Kippers next?
Yeah, because I don't understand.
See, I think that's one of the reasons. I don't understand that.
He was 19 when he wrote this song.
I know, but it.
Well, I guess
can we have kippers? Mighty deer. They gotta.
Don't know that kippers aren't that expensive in Texas. You don't even have to have an oil well to eat kippers.
So what are kippers? Are
they, really?
They're fish.
They're fish, right?
It's smoked herring.
That's right. That's right.
And it's delicious. I eat kippers, smoked kippers very frequently. It's a good meal because it's a fish at the bottom of the food chain, so mercury doesn't accumulate in it.
I don't know if it's because this... I listened to album-oriented rock stations when I was a teenager, but I thought this song was bigger in the U.S. than it is. It only hit number 62.
Really? I thought it was a hit.
Yeah, me too. It was number 9 in the U.K., but it was only 62 in the U.S.
I don't think
that surprises
me.
I heard this on the radio all the time.
It was always on the radio.
Yeah, all the time.
It's one of the four I'll mention that you heard all the time, even if you didn't want to.
Yep.
You can still walk into Harbor Freight and hear it.
It wasn't. Well, it wasn't played on Kix FM in San Angelo, Texas.
Anyway, I like this song.
I think it's good, but it has one of the problems that this band has, and it may only be me, but I can see girls singing this song and playing patty cake or skipping rope. Take a look at my girlfriend. So there's something about their music that is that way sometimes.
Well, it's whimsical,
and it's especially this one. And then you have the toy piano playing, and that doesn't help.
That's hilarious.
But it is a good song.
Yep.
And we got next. We got the Oh Darling.
This isn't the
one you want.
Gather from your comment, you're not a fan of this song, Doug?
There's nothing for me. I like his voice.
I like this song a lot.
I do, too. I think it's catchy as hell, man.
Yeah. I never got his hooks in me.
The keyboard, this is the keyboard work on the bottom. If you listen really closely, there's just some intricate keyboard stuff going on.
One of the things I wrote was, it seems very simple, but it's a much more complex song on the when you actually listen to it a little bit.
The guitar
keyboard playing. Well, maybe anyone's keyboard playing sounds sophisticated and complicated next to the chopsticks that we get on the other side.
And this is essentially about a guy. This is Unrequited Love, right? This guy is mooning over somebody who does
He's not getting
feel
his revenge for the
He's
other.
Make some odd pronouncements. Yeah, I'm going to get you, lady. The object of his affection might be a little bit frightened at this point.
I never got that. I assumed he sang that to himself. And not to her. Huh. He's trying to convince, in his mind, he's trying to figure out ways to get her interested. But I like the song. I think it's a nice way to end the side.
Yeah.
I dig it.
It's very interesting. I find it a fascinating song, just the way it's played and the mindset of the character.
Of the stalker?
Yeah.
I didn't ever caught it as a stalker.
I don't either. I'm just saying that because of what you said, and I'm trying to fit in. All right, ladies and gentlemen. I keep having these pauses while I wait for someone to announce the song, but I'm the host.
We'll flip her over.
We're going to flip this record over. Why are there so many hit songs that are number 6? That doesn't make sense to me. Well, ladies and gentlemen, usually number 6 is number 1 on side 2. Take the Long Way Home.
Thank you.
Tramp does like their long intros.
They do.
Well, I love that intro.
I do too.
I think it's a masterpiece, and I defy anyone to find me. I have been critical of the harmonica in past episodes.
It's a good harmonica.
I don't think you can find a harmonica doing something better than introducing this song the way they do.
And the way it ends on it,
too. Well, and also in the bridge, when the sax and the harmonica playing off each other, it's great.
Is that the same guy playing both?
No,
that's Rick Davies playing the harmonica.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow,
yeah.
He nails it.
Yep.
In the shows us, I guess I'm watching after breakup videos with the saxophone guy doing everything. This is a great way to start.
Absolutely.
It reminds me of another track six and how it has that intro and how it breaks upon you. It reminds me of take Foreplay out. the beginning of Long Time.
Yeah.
It reminds me so much of that, the way it just builds and builds, and you can't wait.
You get that dramatic piano kicks in.
Instead of the guitar coming in, you get the harmonica coming in.
And then the harmonica is huffing away, and then the piano changes into that kind of bouncy rhythm, but it's not that chopsticky thing going on.
That's actually Davies.
Yeah.
Hodgkin's playing that part, piano part.
And I love those, towards the end of the song, the way it fades out with those Beatley ahs and oohs.
Yeah.
It's just really great.
It's well constructed. I've
got a question for you.
Yeah.
So this song is in C minor, as is Breakfast in America and Logical Song. Uh-huh. That's not a usual key for hits to be written in, is it?
It's a relative minor of E flat, and E flat is supposed to be I don't know, I've heard a lot of people in bands that I've played in, whenever we would play an E flat, it would be like a soft song, but I've also heard that symphonies love it because it gives it such a bright feel. So it's a but when you go to that major, it gives it, that's why it gives it such a bright, bright feel. But it's not something that rock players usually play out of.
C minor key is the same notes as the E flat major. You just start in a different place when playing them.
Yeah, it's the same scale, but you start on C rather than E flat.
And this song was written for the album. Was it the one of the last songs written about there? It's written right before.
This sounds like a song that was written after they spent some time on the road.
Yeah,
he comes home. It's a very it's something that sounds like something I could relate to. You're out on the road and you're such a big deal.
Well, that's what he says.
You come home and your wife says, have you taken the trash out yet?
In a press conference when this album was released, Hodgkin said that the song's about a guy who thinks he's really cool, but he's the only one who believes that or thinks that. Huh. But in subsequent interviews, he says that it's a metaphor for the universal journey of self-discovery.
I think I believe the first.
Yeah.
I think it's masterful in that. When you're up on the stage or so, it's unbelievable, and it's so nice. And but then
it's like the limelight.
Yeah,
talking about being in front of the crowd and everything, and then there's the other side of it.
Uh huh.
The guy keeps coming up and talking to him about
like
something.
I can't pretend a stranger is a long acquainted friend. Question for you guys: so somebody offered them $5 million to use this in a commercial. Any guess? What company did that?
It's got to be a car company.
A long distance company?
No.
I don't know.
Greyhound Bus.
Oh.
And they refused. They said, no way.
Greyhound went bankrupt shortly after that.
So number 10 on the Billboard Hot 100. It's number 4 in Canada. And this is the staying power of the song. In a 2006 poll in Mojo Magazine, it's listed as the number 5 favorite song. In the 2006 poll.
Really? In the United States?
In Mojo. I don't know where Mojo is based out.
I don't know where it's based out either. But
it sounds like New Orleans. But I know that's not true.
Yeah.
Or a Permian Basin. One at the Mojo in Permian High School.
Yeah.
Anyway, outside of Texas people, I apologize for that. This is a really, really great song. A great way to start side two.
One last thing.
It starts making me feel sorry for
what's coming up. Well, the last thing I want to say about that is I always thought there were strings on this because the way when it goes to that, when he does the chorus, That's an Oberheim synthesizer, I think, because I can't find anywhere where somebody played strings on it.
And then well done.
When I've watched it live at the...
Are all the strings played by that? Because there's not a string player on
this? I don't think
this?
There's no strings on it.
Oh, I've got in my notes somewhere, good strings.
Yeah, me too.
yeah, right there, nice string work.
yeah, that's interesting.
It's an Oberheim synthesizer.
Okay, well, there you go. Where's the Mellotron?
No Mellotron on this, I guess the Oberheim.
All right.
So we're about to go to a song that I think there's going to be some disagreement on.
Disagreement is the fire that keeps us warm, ladies and gentlemen.
All right.
Lord, is it mine? Is it?
This is my favorite song on the album. Absolutely love this song.
It's my least, not my least. It's one of my least favorite songs on the album.
I think when I was a kid, I didn't really like it that much. But as I,
he's calling me childish, Jug.
Back when I was an idiot like you,
I love how it just starts off so, you know, mournfully, and then just all of that the Hammond organ comes in and does that really cool. It gives it almost a spiritual feel. And then I love that, I think it's a saxophone, that soprano saxophone that comes in. Just absolutely think it's masterful.
You like this song as well, Doug?
I do like this song, especially compared to the rest of the album.
Theme-wise or musically? Or both?
Both. I think the theme is not clear.
It's not very clear.
Not well finished out.
Well, I got from it that it's about, you know, trying to find a larger purpose, which seems to be Hodgson's sort of theme.
He does that a lot.
And using struggles and these hardships to bring things into focus. I'll tell you what my deal is with this song. I think it's bogged down by its overt seriousness and bombast. I feel like this song
compared to the rest of the album.
I feel like this song is so out of place. It feels dated to me as well musically. It does not. It feels like 1979.
It's got a little
like nothing else on the album does,
and it's got a little bit of a Broadway show tune start.
Yeah, it does.
Well, and I can see it's night. It's near the end of the show. And there's a sea of people with their stupid lighter up in the air, swaying back and forth.
But
I don't disagree with that.
This song takes me out of the
album. I wish it did something I didn't expect.
This song and the next song take me out of the album a little bit.
Well, another thing, it's an odd. So it goes to that bridge. Give us an answer, won't you? And it must be a thousand voices trying to come through. And that's the end of the song. That's it. That's a very, it doesn't go back to a verse.
Kind of abrupt.
Yeah. He could have gone back to a verse and he doesn't.
And there's something a little hackneyed about the guy. Like, I'm the sensitive person that's plugged into all this, and we're looking for an answer. I'm speaking for a generation. All this.
I still think it's
but
just
a maybe if I were song. In my 20s, I'd be holding my lighter up like an idiot, burning my thumb, trying to go. Yeah. Oh, he's speaking to our generation. We're so misunderstood.
Anyway.
All right. Well, that's nice to have a little controversy in this album between Tony and the right people. we got a song, number 7, just a number
8.
Just I'm not doing well anymore.
Number 3 on side 2.
Just another nervous wreck.
Yeah, my life is just a mess.
You can tell whose song it is by the piano intro, I think.
You know
what? Wurlitzer again.
You know what this reminds me of? I was listening to it this morning and I went, because it always kind of struck me as familiar. Manfred Mann's version of Blinded by the Light.
That's a really good observation. Yeah.
Oh my God, Doug wrote the exact same thing. That's hilarious. Sorry to steal your thunder, Doug.
It also sounds like all those Springsteen songs that you did.
Yeah.
Princess God, she sends me. Where they completely misinterpret everything. Yeah. Yeah. And they change the name. Yeah. Yeah. They're from a deuce to a douche. Yeah. Thank you, man, for me. Yeah. Of course, that was Springsteen's only number one hit when he didn't sing. He got a number one hit. Yeah. That's funny that we both heard that.
I love this song.
It leaves me a little cold. I don't know. His vocals are great on it.
The guitar and the
music's good, but there's just something about it that does not... You talk about this a lot, of Doug. There's just something that's not there for you. I don't know what it is about this song. It's just not there for you.
I love that. The chorus. I love that chorus. And I love how the instrumentation changes.
I don't have anything. There's just something overall about the song.
And like I said, it's got the best guitar solo on the whole album, I think.
Wow, that's saying a lot to defeat all the
what's the competition. Song about?
I don't know.
It sounds like it's about divorce.
It sounds to me like a compensation song, where he don't care about success like all those other people out there. I don't know. When I was reading the lyrics, it just struck me as a little bitter and
I don't know.
Yeah. I started looking at what we were doing next week when I got to this part of the album.
I think that, and I said this earlier, I think after Take the Long Way Home, this album sort of just starts to fall apart. And I don't understand why.
Well, the songs were going, mine, yours, mine, yours, mine, yours. Right. And that stops.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That stops now, I think.
I do like it quite a bit, but
this is one of those where there's the they out there attacking him.
Uh-huh.
You know, like the man or the they that they're cutting my phone.
I don't know. I thought it might have been about a divorce, but he's happily married at the time. If you read the lyrics, you can kind of see that it's about a guy who's maybe out, you know, on his butt.
Well, a lot of
the people who are writing about the lyrics think it's about an estranged spouse.
One of the things I read is that even though they were Hodgkins and Davies were very cordial with each other, that they were starting to fracture. And Hodgkins was really thinking he was wanting to. That was the first time he was starting to think about leaving the band.
Well, yes, that's true. But what I read later, because I think that's the common understanding about the two of them is that that Hodgkins actually said that it was their wives that didn't get along, and when he left the band it was just because he felt that that was the best thing to do, that the two of them got along fine, there was never any problem there, but their spouses hated each other evidently.
Wow, really?
So who knows what the true story is.
But the name of this album,
be the first time that's happened.
The name of this album was going to be Hello Stranger.
Yeah.
And that was because they felt like they hadn't gelled together, or because they weren't writing together anymore.
Yeah.
Anyway. Well, I don't know. Maybe they're having too many piano players in one band. Well, let's have a casual conversation about the next song. Casual conversation.
It doesn't matter what I say. You never listen anyway. Just don't know. What you're looking for. Imagination.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming out tonight.
Can I say, I don't mean this to be an overstatement. It's a bad song.
It's a horrible production. You talk about something that carries the 70s all over.
Oh, my God. That Wurlitzer sounds out of place on the song.
That phased Wurlitzer, yeah.
If that song isn't played every hour on Yacht Rock, I don't know why they have the station.
There's two things I like about it. I like the sax solo, and I'm a sucker for vibes, and so Hodgkins is playing some vibes in the background. I remember I've never been a huge fan of the song. It's probably my least favorite song on the album.
It's not a good song.
he's being ignored by his date or his wife.
Well,
his...
I read online, and I think this is a stretch, that this song is actually about their relationship.
I've read that too,
Davies,
yeah.
But I think that's a bit of a stretch.
Yeah.
Anyway.
It seems like Davies writes these story songs about bad relationships.
He does. All of his stuff is about...
It's kind of like...
He has one where he's dumping everybody and celebrating it, and the rest are everybody...
It's like Robert Smith writes all these mopey songs about heartbreak, and he's been married for almost 50 years.
Why would you bring Robert Smith up?
Does the production remind anyone a little bit of... Go changing.
Reminds me of that. Yeah, it reminds me of. It sounds alike.
Well, the piano sounds very similar to that on this song.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, he's playing a Fender Rhodes, and this is they're kind of similar. They have the same sort
of. But they've got that weird. I mean, whatever he's doing to the
Wollaston,
has that weird sort of echo.
It reminds me of
that something that didn't survive very long after the 70s.
Yeah.
Yeah, it reminds me.
This is what a year after that album.
Yeah. It reminds me of. Jimmy Buffett. Margaritaville.
Bring up Jimmy Buffett. You brought up The Cure and Jimmy Buffett in the same song, Jam. What is wrong with you?
Sorry.
Anyway.
Well, fortunately, we don't end there. I may not be saying that in a few minutes. this is another song, Child of Vision, the last track. So, what do you fellas think about Child of Vision?
I don't really like the singing. I don't like the lyrics all that much. I don't find them all that interesting. I find this song fascinating. I find the playing on it unbelievable. I love the extended piano solo that's on it and that saxophone that's in it. I mean, that saxophone kind of sounds like at the very end, starts sounding like a mosquito buzzing in your ear, but then it flattens out. But
what do you think, Doug?
I'm done.
This is one. This is a weird song. It's like what I would call a kitchen sink song. It's like
throw everything
in it. It's combines elements kind of that you hear throughout the album.
It's got the synthesizer and the piano.
I don't like it.
Huh.
All three of them sing on it too. I mean, I say all three of them. Davies, Hodgson, and Helliwell sing on it. Hodgson also plays the vibes. Yeah. On it, and then the Slide Hyde guy plays trombone and the tuba on this song. You know what? I'm going to say something. I had flashbacks of listening to the outro to Layla when this song kicks at the end. It's like got that long meandering. It's like, can the outro please end? Please end. Please.
I agree with you that I was ready for it to end, but I could listen to the outro of Layla for one full album length.
Well, I think it is a full album length.
Dwayne,
so there you go.
Dwayne Allman, who I think is considered a fairly good guitar player.
Knocking his guitar playing.
Beautiful bird noises.
God-awful outro is what I'm knocking.
Well, that's what's in it, man.
Well, knock this, the bass playing on this is
incredible. Who's playing that?
It's that Dougie Stockmeyer.
Dougie.
I don't. I this song comes on and I start to glaze over.
Well, and it's also it's another attacking the world.
Yeah,
that he participates in from the outside, even though he's not.
Yeah, I just you just compare the first side. I just sound like a broken record. Compare the first side to the second side, and it's
And this is the first time he gets grumpy.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work well with his voice.
He's kind of grumpy on the Logical song.
I don't think he's grumpy. I think he's I don't think there's a line in the birthday prayer that we say we're unspotted by the world. And I think he sounds unspotted by the world he's describing, because he's still free of all of it. He's still like the bird flying around, and he's just saying, why is it this way?
Okay.
But I don't, on this, he's not just spotted. Covered up.
Yeah.
Anyway, so fellas, that is the 1979 album, Breakfast in America, featuring what may be one in the top five greatest album covers of all time.
Yep.
And 20 million songs, 20 million albums sold worldwide, which puts it into the top up there.
You know, it's kind of weird. This was not a well-regarded album. I mean, it wasn't.
Rolling Stone wasn't kind to it.
Yeah, there were people that weren't kind to it, but now it's on lists of albums that...
That's the way it always is. I know, happens is they're like, holy cow, the buying public loved this. Where were we wrong? Yeah. Oh, we've got to reassess our view of things.
Right. That guy,
I bet you it's
that guy
here.
Messed up.
I haven't
up.
Even looked in this, but I bet you anything it's in this 1,001 albums you must hear before you die.
Yeah,
it is.
So...
Well, do we want to talk about what happens to the band afterwards?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
They break up, and then they all suck.
Well, they make one album, one more. They make a live album.
They make a live album.
Paris.
And that actually had, I think, Dreamer on that was number 15. The live version of Dreamer was number 15 single on it. But yeah, go ahead, Jamie. You're going to talk about Famous Last Words.
Yeah. So Famous Last Words was the last album that Hodgkins was on. The first album they made in the '80s. So it suffers a little bit in the '80s production, but it's got that song on it. It's Raining Again, which I think is a pretty
good
song.
Shall we remind people what that sounds like?
Yeah, that's a good song, even though it sounds like a sitcom's about to start.
It is an earworm, that's for sure. It's hard to.
And the thing, it's kind of cool. It's raining, it's pouring. That little nursery rhyme song goes through it.
They don't need to remind people of nursery rhymes while that guy's singing.
Well, that album was a big hit.
Yeah.
I mean, it number one in Canada again.
Yeah. I don't think it was as big here in the United States, but
You know, sometimes if you sell 20 million, the next album's going to do well no matter what.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. The funny thing about that is when they were working on this album, Davies decided he wanted to go a different direction. And this is one of the reasons I think they broke up. He wanted that Brother Where You're Bound song, which is the title track off the album following this. They wanted to do that. And it's a 10-minute long sort of return to the proggy stuff.
Yeah.
Davies is like, no way. We're not doing that, and he vetoes it. So
who says no way?
I'm sorry, Hodgkins says no way, and they veto it. And so, yeah, he ends up. They go on a tour, and while the tour is going on, he announces he's not going to be with the band at the end of the tour. So they end up breaking up. And the two guys end up breaking up, and Davies goes on without him and records that Brother, Where Are You Bound, Where You're Bound album, and released in May of '85, I think.
Yeah.
And that's got the song, the title track on it, which has David Gilmour playing guitar. And you listen to it sounds like you mentioned Pink Floyd. Sometimes their music sounds Floydy. That Floydian. That song in places sounds very like that era.
Floydacious.
Actually, a little earlier, probably Wall era Floyd.
So they go on to make a couple of more albums after. Well, more than a couple more, but they make some studio albums throughout the 80s and 90s. I'm not sure what they're doing now.
I thought they broke up in 88.
Is that right?
Yeah, and they may have gotten back together after that for a while. I think there were some talks of reunions. I don't know. Did the guys ever play together again?
I don't know. I don't think they did. Yeah. I've never seen anything.
Have you ever listened to any Roger Hodgson's solo stuff?
I tried. It's not my cup of tea. It's real synthesizer-y, real, and it's not, I mean, as much as I like, since it's a little bit 80s synthesizer-y that kind of genre I'm not too fond of.
Gotcha.
So this brilliant little flash fades away, and we're left with this album to consider and to review. And if you're familiar with our program, you know we give two reviews. One is our personal feeling. How much do we like it? How likely are we to put this on again? And the other review, we try to pretend we're critics, and we try to be cold and only use our intellect to describe how we would rate this album. And speaking of coldness, Tony, give us a cold, hard review of this one.
Okay, critically, I'm giving it a 4. I think it's a 4, a good solid 4 in terms of commercial success, what they were trying to do. It is, I mean, it's the Supertramp sound in spades. Mm-hmm. Personally, I'm going to give it a 3. And that might be slightly high. There are songs on this album I like a lot. But overall, I mean, there's 10 songs on it. There's probably 5 that I could be fine with not hearing again. But the other ones are great songs. So how do you balance that? I did get rid of my album, like I said, which I think speaks to that I just, I got a little tired of it. It was kind of nice to revisit it. And there were songs that I had forgotten how much I liked, namely, you know, The Logical Song and,
Goodbye Stranger.
Yeah. Goodbye Stranger. Thank you, JM, for reminding me of that. So yeah, 4 and a 3.
All right, I'm going to go to myself next. As far as a critic, I think 4 is about right. That's where I'm going to land too. This album has things about it that are strong that don't matter to me, but would matter to a critic. There's some imaginative writing from both songwriters. Well, personally, I'll give it I think I'm going to go 3.5. This is like a house with some spectacular rooms in it that are just done nearly to perfection. You love spending time in them. But when you walk out into the hall to go to another room, it leaks. There's rats running around in the hall, and you don't like the rest of the house. And that's how it is for me.
That's a 3.5 house for you? That's pretty good.
Well, the rooms that are strong are wonderful, and the rooms that are, they're just rooms I would pass through as fast as possible. That's all I got, JM. I'm sorry. How about you tell us the definitive review of this album?
As a critic, I think this album has confused critics for a long time. It's like I said earlier, it's been fairly well regarded, but I think some of their catalog is rated higher, and I can see why. There's nothing, I'm not really sure that it's, the word I keep coming back to is it's a little bit childish, and I think that it's something that I was a teenager. I got into this album a lot.
No, I get that. Yeah. I mean, there's albums I still own and listen to and I love, but if I were to pull back from them.
Right. And I
Business as Usual is one of those albums for me. I love that album, but I don't know if the 54-year-old me would love that album.
Do we need a check?
I mean, it's the singing is unremarkable. Even the playing is not anything all that.
I think there's some remarkable singing on here.
Well, I don't know.
We ought to shut up and let you review your album.
I think that the playing serves the songs very well. So I'm like, Tony, when you said, you know, you got rid of your album, I didn't get this album until 5 or 6 years ago. And I was saying earlier at the start of this, I completely forgot about it, you know, until I heard Breakfast in America 5 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago. Anyway, all that to say, as a critic, I'm going to give it a 4.0. Just like you guys, my personal rating is a 4.5. Again, I think that the playing really serves the songs. I think that the voices really serve the song. I do get tired of Hodgkin's voice a little bit. I love the way that the instruments come in and out. I'm just every time, it's one of those albums that, you know, the more I listen to it, the more I get out of it. And even that song, Casual Conversations, which used to be a song that I would, when I could, fast forward through. But now I actually like it. So anyway, like I said, I'm just going to give it a 4 or 5. I even think it has a sense of humor, which I think as I grow older, that's something that I, you know, it's a subtle sense of humor, but it's, as I grow older, it's something that I look forward to and out. Like, I want to hear a little bit. I don't want it to be all heavy and everything. And so as I get older, I kind of like having a little sense of humor in the songs.
Well, thank you, JM, very much. Thank you for that pick. We're going to turn it over to you so you can tell us. I hope next week's pick's not too much like this one. but I'll turn it over to you, JM, so you can sign us out.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Doug. And thank you, listeners, for letting us fill your airwaves again with another episode of This Is Vinyl Tap, the podcast that always goes to 11. As always, if you know anyone who likes the long player format, please let them know about this podcast. And we're available on most podcasting platforms. And if you're up on one of those podcasting platforms, please leave us a review or give us some stars. We're always looking for feedback. You also can visit our group Facebook group page if you're so inclined. Also, if you're old school like I am, you can email us at tappingvinyl@gmail.com. But of course, for the ultimate This Is Vinyl Tap experience, please visit our website. There you'll find links to all our past episodes, pictures, videos, information about the artists that we've talked about and the albums. And you'll also find all of our recommendations. It's www.tappingvinyl.com. Next week, we're going to be looking at a Texas singer-songwriter, probably better known for his songs and for his own recordings, the album by Guy Clark, Old Number One. Host Doug Cooper, our co-host Tony Slagle, and me, your humble producer, Jonathan J.M. Rowe, reminding you, take the long way home.
Make note of all good wishes.
Hodge. What the hell? How do you pronounce his name?
Hodgson.
It's.
We're losing Canadians. This is a casual conversation,
no,
Tony.
Just another
nervous wreck. Which is, you're making me, by skipping this song, you're making me just another nervous wreck.
Well, I wanted to make. I was getting the feeling that y'all were starting to check out, so I thought I'd throw that in there.